wait for a few other people to come. Some of you were here yesterday, and we didn't quite have enough time to wrap it up. We can't go through all of those case studies. We were talking, those who weren't here, we were talking about some of the issues between the public good and private rights, and how there's, where is that boundary where you're willing to pass a law, especially in the U.S. where you have property rights. So how much can you pass for the sake of the common good before you really tick off the people who believe that they've got private property rights? And that boundary continues to shift. It has shifted from the beginning of the country, and it's going to be around until all of us are in the grave. So that it's a case of how does that go along the line, and you end up with a lot of complicated questions. Just a few of the key law cases. The names, of course, you won't remember, but one of the most important was 1926. Euclid versus Ambler Realty Company, and that's when zoning, many of us know in cities where you can have certain things, where you can, even if it's your own property, you can't put a business there because it's right in the residential neighborhood, and where can an industry go? Can't go here because this is a retail area. That was first law, was in 1916, and someone challenged that and said, hey, wait a minute, this is my private property. Ambler Realty Company did that in Ohio. Euclid had a zoning law, and the Supreme Court ruled zoning is okay. And so knowing that these are the things that can be accomplished by zoning, this can occur in a lot of places. You can deal with anything that will lessen the congestion on roads, secure safety from fire, panic, and other dangers, promote health and the general welfare, and that's a broad term, provide for adequate light and air, prevent the overcrowding of land, facilitate the adequate provision of transportation, water, sewage, remove schools, parks, other public requirements, promote orderly and appropriate growth, conserve and develop natural resources in a wise manner, preserve historic and scenic attractions, maintain quality farmland, conserve the value of buildings, promote sustained stability of neighborhoods, encourage the most appropriate use of land through the municipality, prevent undue encroachment on particularly valuable parcels of land, and secure economics in government expenditures, such as preventing waste. You can pass zoning to do any of those things, and it's constitutional. So we always teach that to our planning students, say, you've got a lot of leeway. There's a lot of things that you can do on behalf of the common good, and the Constitution has affirmed the right to have zoning approved through appropriate channels. And it's up to each community to decide how many of these things they want to include in the zoning ordinance. We already went through Penn Central yesterday, which was you can have a zoning ordinance as long as you allow some of the people to have some use of the private property. And so in the case of Penn Central, you remember, they took away the right to build a tall skyscraper, but they could still operate a train station. And after all, that's what Penn Central was. It's a railroad company. The law by New York wasn't taking away at all their right to be a railroad company. It just said, we're not going to allow you to intrude on top of something else. And so that was a key decision, and a lot of other decisions, if that ever comes up, you can regulate a private property, but you have to allow them some use. There was an interesting case involving the Lutheran Church in this. The Lutheran Church, First Evangelical Lutheran Church versus the County of Los Angeles in 1987. There was a floodplain land, Low Creek, and some flood land right near, and then some forest land kind of going up. There was an entry at the end coming in. They had a building, about the only building at the church camp, was on that land. Well, it got flooded badly in that section, destroyed the building, and then they refused to grant them a permit to put it back in there because they said, this is floodplain land, you can't do that. And so then they petitioned. They said, that's unfair, because the only reason we have a church camp is to be able to have a camp. It would be like at home. Take away all the buildings here, and they said you couldn't rebuild. And you'd say, wait a minute, the only reason you have a whole village is because you have a camp here. And then they say, well, too bad, can't build there anymore. In that case, then, the court threw out the decision by Los Angeles because they were taking away all of the uses of First Evangelical Lutheran Church of the property. So therefore, they were allowed to build it. Fortunately, they then had one of these funny court cases again. When they then had the chance, they went all in trouble to win the court case, and then later they decided, maybe this is flood-prone, so maybe we won't put it there anyway. So, but it did reaffirm the idea on this public bound, public boundary, you can have public laws for the common good, but you must allow the owner of the property at least some use of the site. And so therefore, it could be on a homeowner, they can request, can't do this, can't do that, and you still live there. As long as you can still live there, okay, that's okay. And the other one to note, Lucas versus South Carolina, we mentioned it briefly. If you're trying to have a bound something like that, Lucas, remember, won that case, but it was sent back by the Supreme Court to South Carolina, not so much because of public-private issue, but it said that the law as written in South Carolina was not firmly explained in terms of the reasons for it, so they used the term background principles. And at first, planners and environmentalists were really worried, oh man, what does it mean here? No, you can't prevent people from going here and there. But once people looked at it carefully, it was a reminder to the planners and the environmental people, know your science and get it written into the document. Because if you've got good, solid, firm evidence to back this up, where you've got scientific evidence for it, good, solid background principles, then it's okay to rule against a private property's wishes. And there was another coal case where they had lost it in the 1920s, and that was a key one, Pennsylvania Coal versus Mann. They lost the case because of the, it seemed like it was too much of an intrusion on the coal company's rights. Well, almost an identical case came back in 1987. By that point, they knew more science about what happens if you begin to undercut with coal mines going under here pretty soon you will have subsidence of other properties. So on the basis of good geologic science, the second time around, the coal company lost. They said, too bad, you can't do that because you're going to impact these and these and these and these and those people. So that, in one sense, planners, it was a good reminder that you need to sort of get this all together. That's enough of those, but I think in concluding that, that says when we're thinking of this boundary for, in the context of the talk this week, environmental issues, which almost always go across property boundaries. I told Peter Marty this morning, I heard his presentation when he said, you know, maybe in the church where we were too much about boundary markers, and I thought, gee, that does that fit here, that if people focus on what is the key natural process of water or soils or forestry or something else, if you focus on the core, then somehow we have to pass the laws that say that these boundaries between your property and mine, this state and that, are really irrelevant. And that's what we're going to focus on mostly today. I did say, though, you have to have some consistency. And I think that this is my list. You know, if you're on a commission or on a board, or if the board or commission itself needs to come up with some consistency, this is my list. In the first case, if I don't care how many people are in the room, if there's a proposal to do something that I know will go against natural process, I'll vote against it. Or I'll vote for it if it's a positive proposal. So for me, the natural environment comes first. Second, irreplaceable historic resources, human creation such as buildings. I'm a strong believer in historic preservation. If you had some magnificent designer, architect, engineer created this terrific building with all kinds of special ornamentations in 1895 or 1912, that's a treasure of the society, and I don't care if there are 50 people who oppose it, that building shouldn't come down, because that now is ours as a society. We drive by it, we see it, it's part of our common landscape. The third one is true community-level economic growth. Those who were here 2 days ago and make the distinction between distributive benefits, where you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, don't vote for those. But if someone has a proposal coming in that's going to impact three homeowners, it's going to net 3,000 jobs for the community, at that point, I'm going to see the benefit for the community, and I'll vote in that direction. Fourth, for me, the immediate neighbors. Now, that may say, gee, that's a long way down, but a lot of times you don't upset the environment, you don't have a key historic feature involved, and you don't have something that's going to bring a huge number of jobs. A little hamburger joint or a little hardware store, not going to that. So often, immediate neighbors ends up being number one, but that's fourth. Number five, are there any alternative sites and actions? And last, sorry, since may upset some people in the room, the private landowner or developer. So you know where I am. I'm clearly a public good kind of a person. I'm almost always going to vote for one of these other things. And in the end, if the last one would be, if everything else is okay, then I'll support the private landowner and developer. Now, that may sound harsh, like I'm always voting no. It turns out, again, probably 90% of the votes have come up. You don't affect the other five, and you can still have growth. And a lot of communities have shown that. So and while this, again, may sound anti-growth, it's not at all, and we'll get into that today. So that's the wrap up of that. There are other things we could say about some other laws, but we got to move on. So today we're talking about sustainability and population growth beyond climate change and recycling. That is not to say that those things aren't important. Obviously, climate change is immensely important in the long-term future. And so is recycling of materials. But at least from my perspective, disproportionate amount of time is spent on those two items and not much attention at all on some of the things we're going to be talking about today. So that's why we're not talking about, somebody asked, we're going to be talking about carbon credits and anything. No, there's so much discussion about this. And I know in this case, this is just Norm's opinion, but there are people who work for the Fish and Wildlife Agency, there are people who work for the Forest Service, people who work with the wonderful Natural Resources Conservation Service, with soil conservation around the country, and their agencies are getting cut, their budgets are being cut, and everybody at the government says, what are we going to do with climate change initiatives and doing this and this, and they're sort of saying, you know, maybe wetlands and soil and water management and watersheds and wildlife habitats, maybe they need a little attention too. They're part of our life. And so that's all that means. It's not putting down those two. For those, so those of you who are really committed to the cause, is terrific. I guess I focus my time not only here, but again, the title of my course at the college, which has been forever, is at that 100 level, is Water and Land Resources. So I'm talking about the air. And at the upper level, it's Land Resources Management. So I'm glad I'm teaching those things because they happen to be items which aren't getting as much press. So anyway, that's what we'll spend our time on. Sustainability covers a lot of things. It's a new popular emphasis, as we know, in the popular press. But as Larry and Janet and probably some of the other scientists in the room, sustainability as a concept among professional circles has been around a long time. We're going to be looking at something here that was written in 1967, which is exactly, it sounds like it was written last week for the Sunday Parade magazine popular issue. So sustainability has been around a long time. It's the primary popular focus, as we said, has been is climate change, energy alternatives, and recycling. Yet what about others? I've said them, soils, water, including streams, lakes, estuaries, wetlands, groundwater, grasslands, urban communities, forests, we're talking a lot about that tomorrow, wildlife habitat, mineral use. Interesting thing, we don't have time for a survey, but it'd be interesting to know how many of you here have read an article in the general press about any of those things. And so take recycling and the other off. I hope you've read some, maybe your paper covers it. The last one, before we return specifically right to the concepts, is in most of the texts, even now, with sustainability as a popular concept, you may have seen that almost everybody, if it's a real good introduction, will talk about sustainability in terms of environmental sustainability, economic sustainability, and community and social sustainability. It's got to be something that saves the environment. It's got to be something that will work with the economy of a place and be able to be sustainable economically, because we've got to have the economics, and it has to be something that will keep a community of people going. It sort of almost matches, again, those that were here yesterday, that diagram of 50 years ago by Walter Fiery. It's got to be culturally adaptable, environmentally sustainable, and economically feasible. It turns out in 2010 texts are saying almost the same thing. Well, then, another key issue behind this discussion, and that is population. This gets even less attention. This is a wonderful chart of the Population Reference Bureau. If any of you are really interested in following regularly the impact of population issues, population data, obviously, look at the numbers here, this is a world table kind of thing. thing they come out with us every year, and it's widely respected. Based in Washington, D.C., they gather information from all over the world and present this and try and update it. They come out with about 6 publications a year. They have the kids census. So if any of you are interested in this, just you can write to it. I think it's just, I put it on the website of Population Reference, PRB.org, PRB.org. When they and others, including on the U.S. Census, look at the United States, we're 310 million now. And so when I talk with students, it works out. They give the projection for 2050. 40 years from now, so in the current students in high school at age 20, when they're ready to retire at 60, we're going to have 440 million people in the U.S. We're going to go from 310 to 440 million. One-third more people than we have, and 80% of those people are likely to be living in cities. So that means we're going to have environments in the United States that will accommodate urban environments that will accommodate 100 million more people. We're going to have to feed another 130 more million people. These are huge issues to me, and they never make the press. And I think we know why. Once you start talking population, whoa, man, you start getting into some of the stuff that Heidi and others are talking about. You're quickly into ethics and judgments by religious perspectives. Obviously, we can't talk family planning too loud. We can't talk CPG too loud. Can't talk about this. And some people think it's good to have more kids. And so the best way to solve the problem of dealing with population as an environmental issue is just don't talk about it. I don't know how in the public sector people will be able to talk about it and still be able to get elected. You're walking talk about thin ice in an age of global warming. Holy cow, this is a tough call for those folks. But to me, that's why we're going to end up spending half the time here today on soils. Well, we want to talk then about, in the same way with water. So pass these around. This time we'll have this right at the beginning. I'm going to ask you to look at some of these basic processes. I know some of you are very informed scientifically, and you maybe say, what does he think we are, idiots? No, I know some of you could draw this thing, but some of you in the room may not know it at all. Let's see. You pass some up there. You have one more that's down at the lower level. Let's see if we get one more, so he only has to stretch once. Here's one. Okay. Now, again, this was the one overhead I forgot to prepare. But let's look for spend just a few minutes on water. We're going to mostly spend talking about farmland. But if you look at the left-hand chart here, maybe I'll turn this on because then that will allow me to at least hold this up. Let's see if there's a switch on this one. Yeah, right here. If we look at this diagram on this side, many of you know the hydrologic cycle in the most general words. You know, the water evaporates from the ocean and goes over the continent and falls and all of that. I've always liked this diagram that John Mather put together because this focuses on the landward portion of the cycle. You and I aren't going to have much to do with changing the rainfall over the ocean and the evaporation rates over the ocean. And so he focuses in this chart on the landward portion. And so if you follow this, what you would see, you can follow it down. Precipitation comes. Some of it's intercepted by trees. Some of that then drips to the ground. That's what surface storage is. All through the process, you have arrows at points at which evaporation occurs, or a term you may not know, transpiration. So actually, geographers and climate people put those two together. We all know what evaporation is. Transpiration, you all know what perspiration is too. You can get wet on the shoulder, but then you can perspire the water that goes through your system. So with plants, evaporation is the water that hits the leaves and evaporates. Transpiration is the water that's used in the life process of the plants and then comes out through the leaves and everything else. So evapotranspiration is water that's going back to the atmosphere one way or another. So you see a bunch of those arrows. And then you have from surface, some precipitation doesn't hit the trees, falls directly on the ground. Some of that goes over to a river or a lake, and we call that overland flow. Some of it infiltrates down to soil moisture, and then some soil moisture finds its way to the stream. Some of the soil moisture is drawn up by roots. Some soil moisture goes even further down into groundwater. Some of that flows as base flow, which in normal circumstances actually ends up being about one. Anytime you see a river, on average, each river is different, but on average around the country, certainly in our part of the country, the Midwest, anytime you look at a river, about 1/4 of that water that you're seeing didn't come from surface runoff, it came from base flow. And that's why all of us know you can have 3 weeks of no rain and still have water flowing in the stream, all right? Because you're continuing to get the base flow. That's very important. It hits the channel. Some of that then goes as basin runoff. It leaves this particular local area and goes on. Well, once you look at this, this is the hydrologic cycle. Then what we tried to get everybody to think about, the goal then in long-term sustainable water management is to make sure within a given watershed, not just nationwide, but within a given watershed, that this is kept intact in a sustainable way. Sustainable meaning you can come back in 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, and essentially the same amounts of water should be flowing within the system from one place to another. If you start to change any of this, and this is again what I hope you think of and we do too, to get an if-then thinking, we're not going to be able to have a pure hydrologic cycle. So the gentleman the other night when I said, generally kind of keep it intact, and he asked a good question, saying, what do you mean, you know, kind of or close to it? Well, if there's going to be a human society, it's not going to be the same as nature. But if we can think, before we do any changes that would impact water, the sustainable perspective would be we ought to ask, if we do this, then what will happen? And some changes that you can make the change, and it's not going to have major consequences. I was talking with that same gentleman, we had a nice chat. Comes from a book by Barry Commoner, written in the early 1970s at Wash U in St. Louis, Closing Circle. And the New York Times said if there's one book the President of the United States should read, at that point it was Read the Closing Circle. Anyway, he uses this idea, everything's tied together. And then I sort of draw the analogy, sometimes you have circles that are made of very, very strong steel. And in order to cut through that, you may have to saw through it, and when it's all done, it's still such a firm piece of steel that unless you're a heavy weightlifter, you probably still can't pull the thing apart. Well, there are some changes we can make in the environment where you make the change and it really doesn't upset the system very much. So that's why this isn't to say no change. But then there are slinky steels, huh? As soon as you make one, like, oh, gee, you make one little cut and the wire just goes crazy. And so if we can get people to think, what will happen if we do this in the hydrologic cycle? And if they ask the question, yeah, you or I may not know it, but at least then we can hold our public officials accountable. If we do this, before we're going to approve this as a city council or commission or whatever, a state agency, we got to have some scientists come in and give us the best estimate on if we do this, what's going to happen. And of course, the environmental people would say, if this is going to harm the environment, then we'll vote against it. Even other people who've got a different orientation, at least the things are out on the table. We know it's going to be serious, we're going to vote against it anyway. You hope they won't, but at least then they'll be accountable. Now, just a few of the examples on this case. If you cut the trees, and here is a case, look what happens if we cut the trees. This is only one case, but this will happen. This is some older data, but notice about the same amount, this is a true story in a basin, this is the amount of rain that fell, virtually the same. But if you cut the trees, the amount of water coming out of the basin, instead of seeping in and going through some of these side charts, jumps to this. And notice it takes quite a while, kind of bad here. And finally down here, we're starting to get some tree growth again. And that means you're hanging on to the water. You're giving it a chance to drip down into the ground and be used by the soil. If you don't have any, rain hits the ground, ground can't absorb it, it goes off like a water slide. Notice what happens with sediment. Of course, if you like, we talked about Mediterranean, those of you who happened on Monday. Once you get that rain that can hit the ground directly, notice the sediment yield from these fives and sixes to that. And this you could do, this can, river basin after river basin, you could document that if you cut the trees. So clearly, you don't want to cut the trees if you can. We'll say about forestry tomorrow. So if you get more direct rainfall or you cut the trees, then you're going to get more water going quickly to the streams. And that we call stormwater runoff. And look at again what happens when we go from a rural area, get a rainstorm, and with time, rain, the amount of water running off the land increases slowly and has what we say a slow recessional limb. The same amount of rain. Notice what happens when it becomes an urban area with natural surfaces and then a completely sewered basin with highly impervious surfaces, sidewalks, pavements, parking lots, and so on. Notice the amount of water that's now going into the stream in that amount of time. And that's why streams that never used to flood now are flooding. Salt Creek in the Chicago area, none of you, I think, from there, but that's been studied for 40-some years, for at least 40-some years. You can pick any urban area, and this is what happens. When it goes from a rural area, where you get good, on your chart, interception storage, and some good infiltration capability, so you cut the trees, and you put a surface at the bottom, which is impermeable. Wow, do we get the water going off? And that's what we then call, on your chart right here, stormwater runoff. And every community, as I said the other day, every community in the United States is under a mandate that they must have in place and working by 2017 a stormwater management plan. Rock Island bit the bullet on this. It was a tough thing. We had to commit to building more sewers and everything else. Some people said, oh, let's fight it. Let's fight the EPA. It's a dumb old law. And all that, and there were enough people who said, no, we got to do that because if we're sending pollutants and other stormwater stuff in the Mississippi, it's just going downstream. So we passed a $66 million bill. We only have 40,000 people. But we voted yes. The council voted yes. We got to do that. $66 million project in 10 years to make sure that we handle all the stormwater. And now it'll be a system where any water under any circumstance will only, that's not treated, will go into the Mississippi only six times a year for the most severe stormwater event and 0 days a year into the one of the large tributaries going in the Rock River. You have to do, your communities are going to have to deal with it one way or another. It's mandated because of this in terms of quantity and in terms of quality. Somehow you got to find a way to treat it.
Who pays for that? So we, taxes, local taxes, mm-hmm. City taxes.
So we had an extra, had an extra increase. They hope they can get a grant, but we who live there, over the next 10 years, spread out over the 40,000, we're paying $66 million for a stormwater runoff program. And but again, that's I think Rock Island was smart in saying paying attention to upstream, downstream. If we don't do that, we're going to be passing on stuff that people, Muscatine and so on, down all the way to Memphis and New Orleans won't want. So, enough on that. Did you have a comment? Okay, anybody else? So anyway, that's that portion of the hydrologic cycle over here. Another key one, of course, is if we take out, if we put something in here, such as irrigation, which would mean draw an extra line coming up from groundwater, or take some off of the storm, irrigate, it turns out a lot of that water then goes directly back into the atmosphere. And in water management, there is no question that water is the most, they use the term of a consumption use of water. You and I don't consume water. We use it, we drink it, and then we go to the toilet and it goes back in the system. If it's irrigation, it's taken out of the stream and then it evaporates. And the next time you get it is only when it finally may come back as rain. And so some people grumble about Las Vegas, and I think that's a very excessive the way they use some of the water in the fountains. But the use of the water in the fountains actually isn't too bad in Vegas because that's going to get recycled. What is bad is the people who live in Las Vegas and decide they got to irrigate the lawns. All right? And in some way, an urban area in the place where Las Vegas is better than having the area farmed. Because, yeah, we don't like to think about how water gets used, and gee, how is what was in this water the last time around. We don't like to think of that, but at least it is around for more things and more things and more things and more things, whereas the other. So you start tampering, you start inserting irrigation, and you're going to pull this down. A story, Venango, Nebraska, right on the border between Nebraska and Colorado. This is this famous Ogallala groundwater formation. The water's going down at a rapid rate. The scientists say that, but we stopped to see a farmer, and I wasn't sure what we would hear, what his perception was, because it's his farm, and I thought he might be in a state of denial. But there we're on the farm, looking at this wonderful place, his farm, and he shows us how the well works and anything, and then he just says, I hate to tell you this, folks, but the water that I'm drawing on is going down so fast, I'm not sure we're going to be farming on this property any more than 8 to 10 years. And that's exactly what the scientist literature suggests. But this is an average farmer who knows that, and boy, you look at it, man, you can get a much better field than we were looking at. He is worried about sustainable use. So again, if we would have a long talk in water, if you want to talk sustainability, you can find out from people like Larry Collins and other geologists how much water is flowing through a given aquifer, and then how much can you take out so that the amount coming in equals the amount going out. Determine that, and that's the limit. No more water. And they say, well, how can you do that? That's going to put people out of business. Well, if you keep on doing that, you're putting your kids out of business, the next generation. And so sustainable use of groundwater would say you draw upon the literature, what can happen with any of these parts in this diagram. Some leaves the system. Again, once you take too much groundwater out, maybe the next county down, actually, some cities were counting, because water often flows through the dips in the geologic structure, that the next county over would want that. If this takes too much out, suddenly the towns 50 miles away won't have as much water going into the place they. So you've got all kinds of externalities here. You've got all kinds of externalities here. Here would be the point where you put in a dam. You want to hang on to some of this water. So that increases the size of the channel storage in this place. Well, that's going to mean potential decreased flow going on to the next state, the next city, or something else. Or you change the quality of the water. And so then that's going to mean more polluted water going that way. And then we get to this whole thing of upstream, downstream issues in quantity and quality, or this wonderful concept that's been written by this person in a book, We All Live Downstream. What goes in that water, or what you hold back, is depriving them. What you put into it is going to them. So them, in both in terms of ethical issues and in terms of water management, either water quality or water quantity issues, we'll look at what happens downstream. We could go on a long time on this one, but all I guess I'm urging you is, wherever you are, you can share this. If one really is thinking sustainability in water, you somehow need to have some people looking locally so that the different parameters of where water is dripping and flowing and evaporating and so on is kind of understood in your area. And fortunately, the U.S. Geological Survey, which is the one that monitors a lot of the water in the U.S., has an incredible amount of data available for your and my use if an issue comes up and we need to make some decisions. There's some phenomenal data. I have a colleague at Augustana who's just right at the top in terms of understanding of water resources. He could talk to you for the rest of the week about data sources available for water management. So some of you could do that. A quick look on the back side of your diagram, it's not on the copy that I have here, maybe if I can borrow that, is this notion of watershed. I think most of you may know this. The watershed is a land unit. And this is one of the top three things in land resources management. So when you look at this diagram, this is in, near Rock Island. It's a simulated problem I developed. But suppose this Black Hawk mine, someone wanted to put a housing development in there, and they're concerned about what's the water that's going to flow through this whole central basin. You need to find out what are all the land uses within this solid line that I've drawn there for you. The students have to try to learn to do this in my intro class. How do you draw a drainage divide? And that would say that any of the land uses in here are going to affect the quantity and quality flowing. That Black Hawk Mine has long been closed. It's now just a flat piece of potential development land. Understand this idea of the watershed? We got started doing this probably, I've been teaching for 42 years, it was probably about the fourth or fifth year teaching. There was a farmer right about in this kind of situation, a different watershed but the same shape. EPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, had just been passed, and his kids used to go down, and kids and who were there, and then some of his grandkids from his other children, they came and used to play in the stream. And he said, I hear all this stuff about polluted streams. Will you guys do a study? And I said, you don't want to have Norm Moline doing water quality studies. I mean, that's for a chemist or a biologist. But I said, I'll be happy to do, because I said, we're going to have to look at a bigger area. So a colleague of mine in biology and I, we took it on as a team project, and he measured the water quality at different points, and I went this way, and I looked at all the land uses within this area drawn, and so I knew how much farming was there in this. Well, it turns out the water quality people did fine. The water wasn't very good. Looked clean, but it had some chemicals in it. And so Mr. Duman was his name. He was concerned. He knew my grandkids could go down there and be swimming and get the water. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, what can you do about it? I said, well, that's caused by these other landowners up here. I said, there's nothing we can do on that. You're going to have to somehow get together with the farmers and develop a watershed plan and talk with each other. These people maybe didn't know. They're probably good friends of him. They're not trying to poison Doonan's kids. So I said, they just had to go and talk with him and figure, what do we need to do at a watershed level of study? Well, that's why that concept is so important. I invite you to check the watershed that you live in. Some of you, it'll be easy to find out. You're right next to the Columbia River or the Snake or the Missouri. You know it goes into that. Well, look at this one. For the whole Mississippi, everything that's shown here, that's what the people in New Orleans have to put up with. Anything, any pollutants or chemicals that come from that whole area eventually go past New Orleans. And once you start thinking that, again, read this book about, you know, I think the exact title, I think it's close to it, but it is We All Live Downstream. Do you get the idea on that? If you're, so the people would argue in terms of sustainability of water resources, you have to look at the watershed level. And that begins with the nearest creek. One of the little things that we're trying to do in the Quad Cities in Davenport, on the Davenport, Iowa side, has done a little better, but there's an organization in our community, a real good one, citizen activist group called River Action. And they're finding just by putting a name on a creek helps better. Everybody knows the Mississippi River. Everybody knows the Rock River. But then there's this creek that goes behind my house. Is there a name? No. Well, maybe that used to be the Wilson Estate. So let's call that the Wilson Creek. Or maybe this is near Longfellow School. So let's call it Longfellow Creek. And they're finding that if there's a name that attracts to any, the littlest stream that goes by, if it's got a name on it, suddenly people realize, gee, Longfellow Creek goes into Wilson Creek goes into the Rock River, Rock goes into the Mississippi. They are all connected, so I guess I better pay attention to Longfellow Creek. If it's just the creek, who knows where the creek goes? That's what some, just a little thing. But sustainability in water would have us going in that direction. Well, we got to move on. That's water. Got to pay attention to it. I don't think it gets too, well, it got attention in Rock Island when you say you're going to pay $66 million. That'll get a quick attention, won't it? That'll get it on the front page. If you take one more look then at another diagram here, and this is the soil cycle. This one's easier to explain. This is what keeps, it's called the nutrient cycle, what keeps soils in good order. So the key is this clay humus. Soil is made up of organic materials, decaying plant, animal stuff, compost coming out of Holden, and it's composed of geologic materials, the clay type stuff. Clay, so it's called a clay humus complex, and out of that you get your living vegetation. And then they die, and you get a nice flow. This is the way it should work out in a natural environment. Sometimes we harvest the stuff, people eat that, and then it's sewage, traditionally, came back into the ground. Animals are out eating in the pasture, their excrement comes back in like that. Occasionally some stuff blows in. Some of the parent rock is always breaking down and moving up, and you get leaching. Some of the good nutrients are washed away in deep transport. You can see the whole system. The goal, again, in sustainability, it's relatively simple as a statement. Any place ought to make sure the nutrient cycle is intact. The other thing in soil is you talk about a soil profile. You take a cut in a hill, you can see the topsoil. Usually, if it's a good place, a good black dirt, and then other layers on down. We call that a soil profile. And I know it's oversimplifying, but if you want good soil management, you maintain the nutrient cycle, and you keep the soil profile intact. And that's fine. But now, look at some of the modifications that you make in the cycle. Human beings eat the vegetation. It comes here, but we don't return the sewage. We have sewage treatment plants. And then whatever's left goes to the landfill and buried. Animals eat the stuff, and many of them aren't out on pasture. They're in animal feedlots, so that also has to be treated, thank goodness. And whatever's left goes off to the feedlot. Well, you take away that arrow, and you take away this arrow, and the living vegetation, since it's being harvested and eaten by one or the other, there's not as much of that coming back. What's the return flow in the cycle? So no wonder you got to use fertilizers. You got to use manufactured fertilizers. And I'm not saying that's all bad. Actually, some of the fertilizers that are used are good replacements, and we have to do that. We're not going to start spreading human sewage across the land again. China does actually a very good job of what they call night soil. In the rural villages, they collect urine by waste, and it goes out the next day. And even in some of the municipalities, they collect it. And even in the United States, if any of you buy bags of Milorganite, it's still available, I guess. It's a fertilizer. That's Milwaukee's organic waste. Okay, Milorganite. Some of the waste from Chicago is shipped down the canals and goes to fertilizers. I'm not sure if it still does 2010, but it has still relevant. It goes down and fertilizes some of the orange groves in Florida. Dried out, treated, so it's safe. The sewage stuff that ends up being used. We don't have a lot of it. So we want to somehow find a way to retain that. So these are the two cycles. Yes, please.
When you say that the treated sewage ends up in a landfill, that doesn't make it back into the...
It doesn't, because now landfills are so managed that essentially a well-run landform is like one huge garbage bag with very, very, very thick materials at the base with several different kinds of polyesters and so on and so forth. And so in anything that goes in there, that water is not continuing to go down, and they'll vent some of the methane. And then when the landfill is finished, essentially you're sealing up the garbage bag again. And so that's why more recent landfills, it used to be build a landfill and then plant some trees and other things like that on top of it. That'll be great. Now they don't even want you to do that because those tree roots eventually may punch through this bag, and so therefore you put grasses and so on top of a landfill, but not trees. So that's essentially contained there forever. Yeah, it won't, if it's well run, there's no filtering of that back for anything. Good question, though. Thanks for asking that. Now, when we think of soil formation, for the soil nutrient cycle to be in place, as I indicated the other day, in Illinois, there's a soil, there's something called the Universal Soil Law Sequence, well, it's around the country. It's been around for 20 years. The Universal Soil Loss Equation. And now it's a revised one, so they call it the RUSL. The revised Universal Soil Loss Equation. That is set up so that a farmer can look at some of the different variables. And there are six variables, and one is the amount of rainfall, the soil type, the length of slope, the steepness of slope, what kind of a rotational system the farmer may be using, and then is the farmer using some conservation measures? You can get numbers for this, and you can calculate. In the end, what you have here, the amount of soil loss is supposed to be, in our area, in most places, no more than 5, and in some places they really recommend no more than 3 metric tons per tons per acre per year. Tons per acre, and I told you the other day, a sheet of paper sliced across a football field. Football field's about an acre in size. And so if you could slice off a sheet of paper like this for that acre, that's 1 ton. And so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, even if I'm on the generous side, that is all the soil loss that we can have in sustainable soil management. Because that's the rate at which in our area, which has pretty good humidity and good weathering of the rock materials down many feet below, this is the rate of soil formation. So in Illinois, they passed a law in the 1980s called T by 2000 to get farmers to become compliant with that. And it's amazing. They have done a very good job. It was a statewide regulation, T by 2000, and that got those farmers alerted. You better start managing your land so that the soil loss off of your property is less than this per year. And if they achieve that, the grandkids of our grandkids should be able to come back to Illinois and still see that soil profile intact. You see a central idea of sustainability in soil management. Yeah, Jim?
Norm, along Interstate 80 by Davenport, there are sod farms.
Right.
How do they, I mean, they take off, what,
an inch? Yeah.
More? How do they sustain their land?
Well, they put, I don't know all the details of it, but they certainly put a lot of fertilizers in there, and I don't know how long, how sustainable those are. I've not done a study on what is the long-term sustainability of sod farms. The ones I know in the Chicago area that aren't sod farms, it's probably a pretty good, they're right next to the suburbanizing area, so there's probably a pretty good bet that in 10 years it's going to be covered by a city anyway. So I suspect that sod farmers aren't particularly worried about long-term sustainability of the soil for corn, soybean, wheat production. I've not seen a study. It's, again, a great question. So when we think of that, we've got to reduce soil loss. I want to show you a few slides of some really terrific conservation measures that are at stake in this, but some bigger measures even beyond that that I hope I support. I think they're terrific. In the United States, they started in 1985. Again, common good trumped farmers' wishes. And farmers, they didn't want to have new regulations. But they passed them what's called the Cropland CRP program, Cropland Reserve Program, in which if land had been used, and through science it is known to be highly erodible, then farmers could take it out of production and get paid for taking it out of production. And a lot of urban people who don't understand it, they just get upset. What's our nation coming to? We're paying farmers now not to farm. It's one of those things you can pay them not to farm, or you can pay later by having a lot of sediment in the water and crummy soils for our grandkids. So you can pay soon. It's like the old Fram oil filter. Pay me now or pay me later. So I'm a strong believer in the CRP. Now, some people abuse it, and some of you, maybe half of you, could say, yeah, I know, but I know these farmers, and they do that. Okay, there's some abuse. But it's done a terrific job. If farmers did follow that and they were tied in with this, then they would still be eligible for crop support if there was some kind of a crop failure. If they didn't, they weren't eligible. Or if they wanted to keep farming, the other part of that was called the conservation compliance. So if you want to keep farming, and there are more of that than CRP, you want to keep farming this erodible land, then they have to submit a plan of how they are going to reduce that soil erosion below that amount, an acceptable amount. And they have to submit the plan, and if they do submit the plan and it's approved, then they're still eligible for benefits. If they continue to farm on highly erodible land, determined not by somebody's opinion, but by science and slope and soil type and all of that, then they are eligible. If not, they lose the benefits. So obviously farmers really got into this. And at first they objected, oh, geez, now it's intruding in my life. Well, then came 1985, probably a pretty good chance it would get approved again under the Clinton administration. The Democrats, frankly, tend to support the environmental stuff more. But then what happens when it was going to come up in the next round? In 2005, in the 2000s. Because a lot of farm communities are on the Republican side, and at first they thought, well, here's our chance to get rid of the CRP. And by that point, farmers had bought into it. So the farm community supported it. They could see their land was better off. The farmers who were complying, man, we're not losing as much soil. The farmers who were in CRP and they got the extension on their contracts, they were getting something and they can still do a few things with that and they were doing fine. And so it got renewed again. And the night, so that's the CRP, the conservation compliance. And then one of the exciting things now that's just come out, it's last year, and our local people in the Soil Conservation Service are very excited about it, and that is, maybe I guess I didn't bring it along, but it's called conservation stewardship. So now farmers, rather than asking for assistance on this project or that project, it's a long checklist, 2 pages of different lines, and farmers, if they commit themselves to, and they even use the term stewardship, to take care of their land for the future, and if they do this, they do that, and this, and that, and have a little wildlife, and take care of the steep slopes, and do that. There's a point system, how they get points for doing each of those things, and if you accumulate enough points, the government will give them, ahead of time, then, a cash rebate on that. So rather than having to design plans for a farm pond, and then hope they can get funded, it takes this broader view of farmers who seem to already be committed to a life of stewardship. A wonderful Christian term, but it finds its way right into the popular literature. If they commit themselves to a stewardship thing, so it's the CSP program, 2008. And our local soil conservation, NRCS people, not academics, not environmentalists, these are the people in the trenches working with farmers. Man, is Joe Gates excited about this. He thinks we've turned. We're now really seeing these rural environments in a long-term way with all the complexities. I think that's exciting. I want to show you a few of these slides of some things before we end up. And let's see if you would turn the lights off over by that back switch. Some really neat things that are, some neat things that are happening. This is a good example of a watershed. Here's the creek, but you know that somewhere about through here and somewhere over through here, whatever these landowners are doing, that's going to drain down into this place. So if you were really to do this, Pastor Marnie asked me at lunch today, what are the ways then you recommend dealing with the common good? And one, I said, you get people, instead of this farmer, and this one, and that one, and that one, all making individual choices, you get them all together and say, how are we going to make sure that this whole set of acres is good for our kids and our grandkids? We need to develop a common plan. Here's what some land can look like. We've seen these. A long-term soil conservation practice called a grassed waterway. It does wonders. I've seen this for this particular spot. I've gone to this place. The person called it to my attention in 1971. I've been going now, that 39 years, and the land is as good now as it was when I first saw it. There has been no deterioration whatsoever. So here you see some watersheds coming down, a little low areas. Oh yeah, try to do that. Sorry, this one doesn't change automatically. Thank you. This is that same watershed. Here's the watershed. Then you know eventually there are going to be sometimes water goes over. So what do? You put in a hard surface here, either steel or concrete. So when you finally get a very, very wet occasion, water goes over like a waterfall. That won't erode, and the surface that it hits won't erode. So that's as good as ever. There you see it. Here you see it under a heavy rain condition. That place has been there since 1971. There has been no erosion backward in this thing. And this used to be a 10-foot gully. That's good management of the land. Here's some tile drainage. Take that water away underground rather than all the water that's coming out. Notice how clean it is. If that would have gone across the surface, carrying water away, that's very sustainable. Terraces. You build these things so the water, you flatten it out. Instead of having slopes that are like this, you flatten them out like that. And everyone in the room knows. follows. You have a flatter slope, better chance water can soak in the ground. Here's the terrace, a little mound here, so the water will collect here behind it, soak in, rather than continuing to erode when it goes that way. These, notice, this is in western Iowa. Man, they do a wonderful job there. Travel across Iowa, Interstate 80. It's pretty hilly, but they've just converted it from this to this and that and that. Here's another one. And these may be 10, 12, 15 feet high. Here's the air view of terraced landscapes. This is excellent management. That's going to be T by 2000. That'll be within compliance. Some farmers are doing this now, putting that stuff back on the field, nutrient cycle. Bring in the swine manure, put it back out. That's not going to affect the corn or the soybeans we get off of that field. This is up by Trempealeau, Wisconsin, Green Earth Products, nutrient-rich compost. Hold the vegetables that we're eating here are this kind of farming, coming from some of the compost. Wonderful farm pond. What that does, it prevents the water, it stores some of this, drops it down through a pipe, and then releases it so that it doesn't continue to erode. Farm ponds are great. Here's another one. This is the new style in farm ponds. Build the farm around like that, put a little island in the middle, and that way some of the turtles and the toads and the birds that don't like people getting anywhere near them, when this is all filled with water, they're going to have a little island there. So now you kill several things. Sorry. you improve a few things. This is southwest Wisconsin, the Mississippi River, and these are called a lot of forest here. And they haven't cut the trees on the slopes, so the light areas that you see here either up are on ridge tops or down in valley bottoms. This is one of the great places in the country for soil management. Typical southwest Wisconsin scene. There we are. Talk about a stereotype of Wisconsin, huh? Here was the place, the Coon Creek watershed, which is right near La Crosse, Wisconsin. They did a study and noticed you can look down through here all kinds of management practices. 1933, they tried it here. Take these ideas right out to the farmer. Don't expect them to go to the state capitol. Don't expect them, some of you are from La Crosse, don't expect them even to drive to La Crosse. You bring the demonstration right next to the farmers. And what they started to do then, here you have, this is called strip cropping. Contour, instead of the water running down, it's going to keep bumping into things. Strip cropping, contour farming. Notice this one, it goes sort of right around the bend. This is a grass waterway, terrific.
Norm, do they move those grass waterways?
Yeah, they won't move the grass waterways. This may be a few years of grass, then this may be put in grass, and then that may be cultivated. So the strips, they can change.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is near Dubuque, Iowa. Great stuff. Wonderful management over here, and I'll just let the rest of these speak for themselves.
Who took these pictures?
Look at that. That is how that farmer is making sure that she or he is getting a good crop yield, and his grandkids are going to be able to live there, and that soil is going to be as good as ever. One of my colleagues at the college, Peter Schell, head of our art department, he borrows these slides. Sometimes it has his kids. This is art in the landscape, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the last one of these. But look at that. Isn't that terrific?
Have you noticed that beautiful things are always environmentally good? I mean, when you finally get it right and you look at it like that, say, that's beautiful.
It really is fun.
They destroyed all of the natural habitat, but it's still a beautiful thing.
Oh, exactly.
They're keeping the soil. We have to eat.
Terrific observation. We feel the same way.
And most of that's no-till, isn't it? I mean,
no, this is not no-till. Okay. Now, that's the next slide. This is not no-till. Now, this one, this is the best of all. Yeah. It's only like you have it in a vertical form, but you can't beat this. In this kind of a situation, you never turn the soil over. Or maybe sometimes it's called conservation tillage, where maybe every 5 years or 10 years. But they had a crop last year, and then they go through with a thin little narrow slit when they're going to put the new seed in, and it covers it right up, and you go look at the field, and you can hardly tell that it's been planted. And on that, let's see, if we could have the lights again, please.
Do they have to use more chemicals?
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Some not necessarily that much more because you're keeping everything within the ground. Look what happens when you then, if you think of that universal soil loss equation, formula, maybe you could, let's see, I'll just turn that off. If you think of that equation, which I didn't want to go into details for you or with you, but the last variable is conservation practice. Everybody in the room knows enough math. If we have this times that times that times that times that, whatever that number is, if the last number you can plug into the formula is going to be something like 0.04, 0.02, you're driving that number down to almost nothing. And that's why a farmer who practices no-till like that last slide is almost always going to be in a situation of sustainable soil management. And it are the area of our part of Illinois, the farmers adopt it a lot. We have some transition land going down. Surprisingly, when you get to places like Champaign, Illinois, which you may not know, but that's very, very flat, very flat. And some of the farmers there are the ones who are, I talked with Soil Conservation Service people down there a year ago on a field trip, and they say, they don't think they have any erosion. Well, nonsense. Almost every bit of land has some slope, and every bit of land is subject to wind erosion, particularly in Illinois. And the guy says, I just can't get these people to do it because they perceive they don't have a problem. Well, they're lucky it is so flat that none of the other numbers really give them too high a number. But it pains, you know, Jan and I, as we drive through that, and to see farmers there who aren't using the zero till. Because and the farmers there, they're trying to get them because they're worried about the long-term sustainability of that. Well, you know, time is up, but the one thing that I didn't get it, I guess I will just wind up with a couple of slides, and while I'm getting ready, I'm sorry we didn't have time. I may save one, it's for tomorrow, but pass this around, please.
Have you heard about Washington Soil Conservation Restoration?
I have not.
It was called Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
They restored it all in one day.
But, you know, and this way, one more time on the lights. And what we have, when we look at the next picture, despite all the soil conservation practices in the world, they're all good, but the biggest threat of all is the loss of that farmland. And at present, and this now it's actually been for 25 years, the United States has averaged 800,000 acres per year of prime farmland that is converted to urban developments. The other is the innocent start, and soon it's this, and soon here it's coming, and soon it's of this scale. This was where our son lived in Madison, Wisconsin for a while, but about 2 years after he was there, oh no, why, there it is, this is what's there, this is by Madison, progressive, liberal Madison, they don't have any farmland restoration program. This is by Bloomington, Illinois, some of the finest soil in Illinois, the Mitsubishi plant. You know what all of that was. We had 180, 190 bushel per acre corn in that spot. You see these, you can take these slides wherever you go. This is up by Harvard, Illinois, terrific farms. Wonderful old farmstead, but notice back here, Motorola plant going in, and there's what happened to the topsoil of this fine, used to be dairy capital of the United States. And this is the slide we end on because of time. But you can see, look at the choice here. Here we have, we're looking at the old farmstead, but then we're looking in the background when more of that has been consumed. And so, again, the lights. So one of the biggest things when you're having even a soil management class very quickly becomes an urban planning class. And what do you need to do in make our cities a little bit more compact? And I think this piece developed by the Chicago Wilderness Organization, I hope you'll study it carefully. We don't have time to go through it, but you don't need me to read it. But number one, the first point they say on the back side of that is, what are policies that we can do in the Chicago area to not cut into farmland? They give 8 guidelines, but then they give all kinds of solutions to this. And when you look at that, this one, you know, it hasn't solved the problem. But when you look, eventually, if you have a chance to look at that, and you see the different people that are in that, you have environmental people, you have real estate developers, you have architects, you have government. And so this, I share that because I'm from Chicago, but even in our land use planning book, this is cited often as the example of what ought to start happening in more places, following the lead of the goals of sustainable development for the city. And therefore, if you do that, then you should be taking less of this. Your neighborhood city down here, Portland, we often cite that. It's also always cited also, where Portland has that urban growth boundary, where they're trying. And then in order to have urban growth boundaries, you draw the limit, let's say, around this table. And any new development, it should go in there. If somebody wants to put a new development over there, I guess you can put the development out there. We're just not going to provide you with sewer, water, or roads. You can do whatever you want with the land, but we're not going to give you sewer, water, electricity, or anything else. So that's a pretty quick way to say, I guess we better put it over here instead. And so it's not perfect, but it's cited as the best example in the country for that. So these issues of soil and water, very quickly, they're important issues. Day to day, and as my last note wrote to myself on this, I sort of liken dealing with a new couple. Person who's 25 years old, a newly married couple, what are they going to be worried about in the next few years? Are they going to be worried about their retirement funds? Well, maybe a little bit, but if they're really concerned about themselves and their maybe coming kids, they're probably going to be concerned about their bank account this year and next year and 5 years from now, while they think about the long term. And I guess that's the way I feel about climate change. Climate change is big. We've got to keep a focus on it. But hey, that's something people say, you know, in 75 years, this is going to be 100 years from now. Yeah, we've got to worry about that, but maybe we've got to worry about what's going to happen in the next 5 years and 10 years. But even this thing here, if you're losing, you're gaining 100, don't forget that. 130 million people, and this isn't radical, this is dependable data as best as projections are. In 40 years, while we are losing 800,000 a year, if we keep doing that, that will mean we will have lost 32 million acres. You and I can go drive by one of these signs and say, yeah, that's too bad, and you lose a few acres by Chicago and a few acres by Seattle and a few acres by the other. But what will it be like for the current 20-year-olds when they're 60 and the United States has 32 million less acres of productive farmland? That ought to be front page news. Hey, thanks for listening.